Tonight on Banfield, free speech is a birthright, but heinous lies will cost you. Got that, Alex Jones? Jones now has to pay almost $1 billion for adding to the anguish of the families of Sandy Hook and putting their lives in danger, too. Also ahead, 2 more months of water and then no water at all. One town's nightmare is the worst fear of cities and towns and even whole states right across the country. Rivers are shrinking, reservoirs are dropping, and you will not believe what is coming out of the fire hydrants now. And then, you've heard of quiet quitting, but there's an even newer trend afoot, and it seems to be an obsession. 50% of us are about to quit our jobs for good. But which 50%? And when are they packing it in? Employers, you're on notice. And later, murder, she wrote, but real life mass murderers, she fled for the sake of her daughter. The late Angela Lansbury was a stage and screen legend, but her greatest role was opposite Charles Manson, for real. It is all straight ahead on Banfield. Hello and welcome. It is Wednesday. This is Banfield. Alex Jones didn't get to where he is by sticking to the facts, right? Can we be real? His vast fortune and moderate fame make that infamy are built on half-baked conspiracies and outright lies. And tonight, it is the lies that just might wipe out the fortune. Clearly, that was the intent of the jury in Connecticut today, the one that awarded nearly $1 billion to the families of 8 small children who were gunned down a decade ago at Sandy Hook. 14 family members in all, plus a former FBI agent. They all got together and they sued that guy and his InfoWars platform because of years and years of incessant, rampant, and completely false claims. Claims that the massacre was a hoax, that it was all staged, that Jones declared the grieving parents actors in a government plot to take away everyone's guns. But people, I am here to tell you personally it wasn't. Not because of the evidence, not because of all the litany of the news coverage you've been watching that proved him to be a liar. I'm here to tell you that Jones is a liar because I was there myself just hours after those kids were shot. I was in Sandy Hook at the edge of that schoolyard and surrounded by horror and bewilderment and unimaginable suffering. Meryl effing Streep couldn't have pulled off what I witnessed among the hundreds of victims, their friends, their families, their neighbors, and all the law enforcement who were forced to go through that bloodbath. All of them left reeling in that little bucolic Connecticut town. And people, I should not have to tell you all of that. It shouldn't even need to be said. But here we are. Fans of Alex Jones believed him. They believed him when he said it didn't happen. And it is more than likely, my friends, that many of them likely still do. Like the rabid fan who urinated on one of the children's graves because Alex Jones told him it wasn't real. Or how about the man who fired his gun at the home of the grieving parents because Alex Jones told them they were actors. The families who were already shattered by the murders of 20 first graders and 6 staff members became targets themselves of all kinds of harassment. 10 years of it. Threats. Attacks. For a decade. Many of them actually had to pick up, pack up, and move their entire families from the place that they buried their kids. Today, some of those families let the emotions that surely were bottled up. They let them come out in court live as the verdicts were read. And they also spoke outside the courtroom.
All I can really say is that I'm just proud that what we were able to accomplish was just to simply tell the truth. And it shouldn't be this hard and it shouldn't be this scary. Everybody that took the stand told the truth except for one. The one who proclaims that that's what he does. But while the truth was being said in the courtroom, he was standing right here lying.
That is Robbie Parker. Robbie lost this little one, his 6-year-old daughter Emily, in that Newtown, Connecticut massacre that I witnessed and whom Jones singled out as a crisis actor. Robbie Jones, acting. That's what he said. Robbie Parker. And, you know, Parker was awarded the highest amount in today's verdict as well, $120 million. There he is, right there, as the verdict's being read. Unbelievable emotion. Look at that. Think of what he's been through. 10 years, right in that moment, coming to a head. As for Alex Jones, tonight, he's calling the judgment a joke. And get this, he is imploring his followers to, quote, flood us with donations.
They want to scare everybody away from freedom and scare us away from questioning Uvalde and what really happened there, or Parkland or any other event. And guess what? We're not scared and we're not going away and we're not going to stop. And literally, for hundreds of thousands of dollars, I can keep them in court for years. I can appeal this stuff. We can stand up against this travesty, against the billions of dollars they want. It's a joke.
Well, it wasn't a joke in Texas. Remember that, Alex Jones? That's where you were back in August and where you lost yet another Sandy Hook lawsuit. Jury there awarding the parents $49 million. But under state law, that amount will be capped at less than $1 million. And we're not going to stop there because there's more reporting here. A third trial is coming later this year. And on top of that, punitive damages have yet to even be decided by the judge in Connecticut. So cha-ching, those are going to be on top of the $965 million that you were levied with today. So wipe that smirk off your face, Alex Jones. But when do the families collect? Can they? Can they? Will they? Will it actually happen? In the Texas case, a forensic economist hired by the plaintiffs estimated that the worth of Alex Jones and his companies is about $270 million tops. That's nowhere near a billion, but that's a lot of money, $270 million. And Jones, of course, is trying hard to even put that money out of reach by moving it around and transferring it and moving his property to his wife and, you know, the typical moves, filing for bankruptcy, which, by the way, the Sandy Hook families are way ahead of him. They're fighting that, too. And amid all of this, it is important to remember that civil cases, civil judgments, they usually do not come with a cop. Collecting on these judgments? Just ask the victims of this guy, O.J. Simpson. Because 25 years ago, Simpson was ordered to pay the families of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman, for who he was discovered to have been responsible for their murders, $33 million. You can add a whole lot of interest over 25 years, and it's fast approaching $100 million. But so far, O.J. Simpson, with his big old grin, has paid only $133,000. And every single penny of that came with a fight for these people in their grief. Because their grief doesn't end. Your golf game may be getting better, but their grief has never ended. Jones can also appeal all of these verdicts like he blathered on about on his show. And his attorney says that that's the plan. But message to your Connecticut attorney, you're going to have to be paid unless you're doing it for the fanfare. As for whether any of this has a chilling effect on a much wider problem, the conspiracy industry in America? Well, that's kind of unclear at this point. Jones hasn't asserted a First Amendment defense anywhere here. He actually lost all of this and got slapped with these hundreds of thousands of dollars because he just didn't show up. And he refused to turn over the documents, as is required by the law and the courts of the United States of America, for which he claims his love. And with that, I want to turn to Mark Eiglarsh. He is a criminal defense attorney and a former prosecutor. And Randy Zellin is a criminal defense attorney and a former prosecutor and adjunct professor of law at Cornell University. All right, Mark Eiglarsh, I'm going to let you have at it first, and then I'm going to hear from Randy on it too. First, the reaction of award after award after award after award. And if you had your calculator going, it's just shy of a billion. It'll go over that, I'm sure, once the judge adds on those punitives. I expect these judgments for, like, cigarette companies and, you know, pharmaceuticals. I don't expect it for a guy with a website.
Yeah, huge victory for the plaintiffs. The analysis starts with, we all, including Alex Jones, enjoys wide latitude under the First Amendment to spew offensive and even outrageous speech. But there are limits, and this jury made that very clear. Lies, defamation, intentional infliction of emotional distress, the harm that he caused these people, there are limits. And they're saying that what you're saying, Alex Jones, is beyond the pale. It's not protected under the Constitution. It's unlawful. And for that, you're going to pay.
Randy, you can't get blood from a stone, right? And if Alex Jones is going to pull an OJ and move money around, stick it in a homestead in Florida, do the typical two-step of a guy that's trying to get shifty and out of what the courts have ordered him to do in the good old United States of America, again, the place he professes to love, what do you do if you're these parents?
It is rare, Ashley, that I'm at a loss for words. I have a knot in my chest right now. I watched a father with his head in his hands. $120 million, $120 billion cannot replace his child. So we can talk about lawyering moves and we can talk about all kinds of great legal strategies, but this is not about money. These people lost their children. I have my children, and just thinking about what they're experiencing, I can't wrap my head around it. Quite frankly, the fact that you had to go on air and say, I was there, this really happened, Alex Jones wins because we're talking about him and we're making him relevant. The best thing for me as a lawyer to say to Alex Jones is, you know what? Go away. Never open your mouth again. Disappear. You don't owe me a dollar. Because all you really want are the Alex Jones of the world, the Steve Bannons of the world, to stop being relevant.
Well, you know, sometimes these massive judgments, Mark Iglarsh, have a way of wiping people off the platforms they can no longer afford to host. And to that note, a lot of people hear about him, you know, declaring and filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy and thinking, well, look at him. He's just manipulating the tools and grinning his way through getting out of all of this. So what's the truth? Can this wipe him off the map? Can he hide his big old ugly insides of his head behind Chapter 11?
Probably. I don't expect the families to get much money, if anything, from this. And I think that they know that. I know that their lawyers manage their expectations properly by saying that a victory is defined by a court telling Alex Jones what you did was unlawful. And all your disciples who've been following Alex Jones, who've been doing harm to all of these families, if they continue to spew their unlawful speech, then they too can be hauled into court and they can lose their financial position. So I think that that's the victory here.
So, Randy, you know, it wasn't but a minute that that judgment came down and he was already spewing again. He even did it sometimes during his trial where, you know, the rest of us who understand how the law works, you think, why are you just handing evidence live in real time to those who are the plaintiffs? But here he goes again. So the question is, as he continues to do this stuff, I don't think he is Mensa material. I don't think he can self-regulate on the air and, you know, shield himself from libel or defamation, you know, on the fly. I know he can't. He is actually pretty dumb. But if he continues to do this, what are the ramifications for additional suits? Can people tie this man up in court literally till he goes to his grave?
Well, the problem is the man can't be tied down because he will spew in front of the courthouse. He will spew in the courthouse. For me, as long as we have elected leaders who take the position that he can walk down Fifth Avenue and shoot and kill someone and get away with it. As long as we have the Alex Joneses of the world and the Steve Bannons of the world and millions and millions and millions of people who follow them blindly, money doesn't solve the problem. What solves the problem is common sense, judgment, and mere humankind recognizing that these insane people need to go away. They need to be muzzled. They need to become irrelevant. So for me, he's going to keep going. And as he said, he'll find people to make donations to pay his lawyers. He'll get people to put up money and buy him a house or rent him a house. He'll have his money in other people's names, people taking care of him. This man's not going to change until the day comes that nobody cares about what he has to say.
Got to leave it there. Guys, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Mark Eglarsh and Randy Zellin doing the legal analysis for us tonight. You know, sadly, lies and conspiracies are starting to become a norm in this country, sometimes about mass shootings, sometimes about Democrats eating babies. Just think that one through. And sometimes about election results. It is the kind of thing that used to be kept in reality check by our institutions. Institutions like the media, which was infiltrated by Alex Jones, and institutions like the courts, the same ones that proved nearly every election lawsuit false, and then today, that court that proved every claim of Jones a lie. And with that, I bring in veteran political analyst Bill Kristol. He's editor at large of The Bulwark. So it's shocking that we're having this conversation about such unbearable drivel that people lap up. But it isn't just about the kids at Newtown. And you know it, and I know it. It's about all of the conspiracy theories out there, Bill. And many of them have to do with politics. Many of them are rooted in some political analysis. And people are really buying into it. And I wonder if today's judgment will even make a whit of difference to those conspiracy theorists.
I hope it makes some difference, obviously. And we owe it to those parents for going through incredible pain of bringing this lawsuit and keeping the memories even more vivid than they would otherwise be, and enduring the sight of Alex Jones, to try to bring definitive judgment home to people. But look, I was out and I came back about an hour ago and looked online at Twitter. Conservatives are defending Alex Jones, or at least they're attacking the lawsuit and how unreasonable the judgment is, and it's free speech. Marjorie Taylor Greene said, Representative Sabatini, who's an actual state rep in Florida, said, hey, Alex Jones should be president of the University of Florida, not Ben Sasse. Just one after another, really. It's hard to shock me these days, I would say, about the Trumpist right, but I didn't quite expect them to become pro Alex Jones, or at least anti Alex Jones, but there we are. I mean, and that just makes your point. I mean, how can this be? If the leaders of that wing of American conservatism, which is now sadly, I guess, the dominant one, they're not willing to distance themselves from, let alone full out criticize and repudiate and say how horrible Alex Jones is.
Well, let's chew on that for a second, because I don't know, maybe I'm Pollyanna, but I really want to believe that, you know, of the 60% of the moderates in this country, I don't think they feel one iota of sympathy towards that man. I don't think they believe in his free speech to hurt people, because that's what we have defamation laws for, right? I think the people you just quoted and people of their ilk and Alex Jones's lemmings, I don't think they speak for a very big part of this country. So I want to actually feel a lot better about how puny those people are. I say it's growing. It is. But let's be real about the comparison. What's your analysis of the actual comparison?
No, I think, look, you make a good point. But let's say Tucker Carlson, who has a highly rated cable news show on Fox News, as you know. He's had Alex Jones on many times, very sympathetic to Alex Jones. I don't know if he said anything tonight or will tomorrow night defending Alex Jones, but he certainly hasn't repudiated having this man on as a guest in the midst of and after all the defamation, all the pain and grief and terrible things he's done to these parents. Tucker Carlson, fine with Alex Jones. Donald Trump, fine with Alex Jones, so far as one can tell. Now, that doesn't mean, as you say, that tens of millions of people are pro-Alex Jones. But it does tell me if some Republicans and conservatives don't step up and just unequivocally say, this man is awful, then they're sort of going along with it. You know what I mean? They're not pro-Alex Jones, but they're not really for distinguishing conservatism, republicanism, the Republican Party, from the kind of Alex Jones conspiracy theories, but also, and I think I would stress this even more, actually, the cruelty. You know, Adam Serwer, yeah, the journalist of The Atlantic, wrote that article, "The Cruelty is the Point," and that's been used a lot over the 4 years since he wrote it. But what I watch in reading those people tonight defending Jones, the cruelty is the point, and it's depressing how many people like the cruelty.
I have like 30 seconds left, but I got to ask you this. You know, the American institutions like the courts, they're the final arbiters of truth, right? And so we had it today. We had the final arbiter of truth bring down the gavel on what's right. And yet we have people who just don't trust our institutions now. I understand why. I know where we've been going these last few years. But my question is, going ahead to elections, what does this tell you about the potential to deny elections and still have legions of fans of that?
It tells me that there are a lot of people out there willing to do it. Hopefully not a majority, hopefully not enough. But, you know, we had January 6th, and look what's happening. Donald Trump is still the leader of the Republican Party.
Bill Kristol, can't wait to have you back. You know you're one of my favorites, right?
Thanks, Ashley.
You take the compliment well, too. Still to come tonight, the end of water in America? That sounds impossible. Sounds like a conspiracy theory in itself. But some U.S. towns and cities are just weeks away from going completely dry, for real. And wait until I tell you what oozed out of their fire hydrants. That's next. Whatever your hopes or dreams for the future, I'd like to add one that probably isn't on your list. And if it is, I am really sorry for you. It's water. You and I can do a whole lot. If we have to, you know, we can do without, but we cannot do without water. We just cannot live without it. But right now, some of us are facing that frightening reality, and millions more of us, actually tens of millions, are headed down that road. Witness the town of Coalinga, California, just outside of Fresno, population 17,000. City officials there expect that Coalinga is going to run out of water by December. That's less than 2 months away. And yes, I said run out of actual water. After that, they have no idea what will happen. But they've gotten a preview. Fire hydrants are shooting out dirt like lava. Lawns and trees are having to be ripped out because they are dead. Residents, some of them have been forced to remove parts of their lungs because the soil fungus is being whipped up by the drought and they're breathing it in. And it is not just happening in Coalinga and not just in California. They're just the canary in the coal mine, folks. A window into what the rest of the country could experience next. I want to show you a map from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. You know it as NOAA. NOAA says this shows the levels of drought around America. And anything you see in yellow, orange, or red, that's a problem. In August, about 40% of the U.S. fell into the moderate to extreme categories. 27% of the country was severe to extreme. Now take a look at these photos of Lake Mead in Nevada and Arizona. It is the largest reservoir in the United States. But as you can see with your own eyes, the water line shows that it's 25 feet down. And people, it's 25 feet down just this year. It's way lower than that. Falling water has exposed sunken boats, old warships, and even human remains. It's so low. And this week, scientists noticed something else really shocking as the water went away from Lake Mead. They found volcanic rocks that date back 12 million years. There is a serious water shortage in the United States. And the cavalry probably isn't coming. You might think drinking water is a right, and you'd be wrong. The only mention of water in the United States Constitution is a reference to reselling captured warships. Water doesn't come up once in the Bill of Rights. So you might be out there on your own. If your city runs out of water, what do? Do you move? And then do you move again when that place runs out of water too? It's a pretty tough bind to be in. And after the break, I'll be joined by two people who might have some answers because they run that drought-stricken town of Coalinga, California. What do they plan to do when the water runs dry? And what lessons can they teach the rest of us? That's next. Welcome back. Across the country, cities and towns are running out of water, and they're bidding against their neighbors to keep the taps flowing. Coalinga, California is set to run out of water in less than 2 months. How is that even possible in America? And are they just the tip of the iceberg? Is there anything anyone can do about this? And what about the rest of us? Are there some lessons here? I'm joined by Coalinga City Council member Adam Atkinson and Coalinga Schools Superintendent Lori Villanueva. Thank you both so much. And I'm so sorry that you're going through this. It's kind of jaw-dropping to read some of the accounts of what I'm seeing in your town. Adam, can you just get me to the point of how it ended up this way? It sort of seems like with only 2 months left to go, I figured I would have been telling this story a year ago.
Right. Yeah. So we got to go back to 2018 when we were allotted 10,000 acre feet of water. And then last year we were allotted somewhere in the neighborhood of 4,400 acre feet of water. And then this year they dropped us back down to 2,200 acre feet of water. So in the last few years, we've lost 80% of our water from the USBR. And that's how we came to the point where we are today. So now we're about to run out of water probably. As we're looking at our projections right now, we're about to run out of water in mid to late November.
I guess the question would be, then what? Literally, are your residents' taps going to stop flowing, or is there some workaround, as awful as it might be?
There is going to be a workaround. The USBR says if we keep taking water out of the canal, then we are stealing water. So we'd be stealing someone else's water. So what we have to do now is find a way to buy water from the private industry. And we have to find vendors. And at that point, it's become very, very expensive. So right now, we pay about $190 per acre foot of water. We're looking at being about 700 acre feet short this year. And per acre foot of water that we're going to have to buy from the open market is going to be around $1,800 per acre foot. So we're going from $190 per acre foot of water that we were paying before, and now we're going to go to about 1,800 acre feet of water that we're going to pay then. So we're going to go from what we would have been paying $133,000 for that 700 acre feet of water. Now we're going to have to pay $1.3 million for that same amount of water that we would have normally paid $133,000 for.
And at 17,000 people, that's almost not doable unless you cut every other spot in the budget. So let me get you in here, Lori, because you're not just sort of the school superintendent, you're also a victim of this. I read that you have these concerns about the school turf is causing injuries with kids, and there's you who's lost part of your lung based to something I saw called Valley Fever, where the soil fungus gets whipped up by the winds, and that's what you all are breathing in. How many other people do you think have what you have?
Thousands of people have it, and it's really prevalent, especially among our local farm workers and people that work in the fields, because this is a fungus that's a natural part of the soils around here. So anytime the soils become agitated, either through drought, wind, agriculture, building, it gets in the air and people breathe it in. And it is a very serious problem.
So, I mean, if you're saying that many people have this, what's the solution there? Because I see that as even more of a crisis than the taps running dry in 2 months.
Absolutely. So some people get a cough and it goes away. Some people, like myself, it gets in your system and it eats away at your lung, and I ended up having two surgeries. But part of the solution of living in an area like this is being able to have turf that covers the ground, keeps that dust from blowing around. And that's a main way to keep this in control. And so it's not just about having green lawns. It's about not having people breathe in the dust, the agricultural products and chemicals that are in the soil, and also not breathing in this fungus that is absolutely everywhere here.
Are the kids getting sick?
Kids do get sick. And as a matter of fact, I was part of something that Senator Caballero did to try to get information out to all doctors in the San Joaquin Valley, and so that they can recognize the signs and symptoms. And it's not only our area of California, but it's all over the Southwest, Texas, northern Mexico, Arizona, and it really is a problem, and it's getting worse with the drought. And every time we have construction or other things that move our soil, the cases go up.
I can imagine. So, Adam, a lot of times with all the drought stories that we're, you know, hearing so often on the news these days, I hear about sort of the workarounds, the solutions being, you know, desalination plants and maybe, you know, reconfiguring how we live, more, you know, dense living rather than subdivisions that use up lots of lawn and space and take up a lot of water. Are any of these solutions for you?
You know, it's hard to say. It's a very complicated subject. We need more water storage, obviously. We haven't had any water storage built in many, many years. We have a water infrastructure that was built for around 20-something million people, and we're well over 30 million people now. We need desalination plants as well. You know, it cost $1 billion to build a desalination plant, and we spent about $105 billion on a high-speed rail to nowhere. We could have had 105 desalination plants up and down the coast. I think, in my opinion, the answer is going to be to put the coastal cities on desalination plants and put the valley and the mountain communities on the aqueducts. And I think that's the best way to handle it, whether or not anyone takes up.
If that doesn't work, Lori, are some of the families in the school district saying they've had it and that they're going to just pack up and leave? Like, how many of the residents are leaving or deciding to leave or making plans to leave because they're just literally scared?
Well, I think there's some fear, but I think it's around work because we're a very highly agricultural community. And a lot of our families, that is their livelihood. And so you saw the pictures of all the trees down. If we don't have agriculture, we don't have workers. And when the workers leave to find that work in greener pastures, literally, that means our children, our community starts to break down because they move to where those jobs are. So I don't think we've seen, you know, a mass exodus yet. But as this becomes more and more real, I believe we are going to start seeing drops in enrollment, drops in our city, and drops in the things that we're able to do in our area.
So, Adam, if I'm watching this TV, you know, broadcast right now and I'm in the state of Maine or I'm in, you know, North Dakota or South Carolina, do you have something to tell us? Is there something that the rest of the country needs to know about what you're going through? Are you the canary in the coal mine?
We certainly are out west. I mean, I don't know how bad it's going to be out east, but we certainly are out west, and we need a lot of help, not just from the state government, but we need a lot of help from the federal government. And I'd ask all those people to, you know, write the president, write their senators, and write their congressmen to start working on these water projects that we desperately need in California in order for us to sustain the most basic need for life, and that is water. We need help. We need help from the governor, and we need help from the president. We can't afford to pay for this kind of water on the open market.
From Coalinga, California, Adam Acheson and Lori Villanueva, thank you both for being on, and good luck to you. Keep us posted on the progress. Obviously, 2 months is like tomorrow.
Right. Yeah, it is. Right around the corner.
Appreciate you guys being on. Appreciate it. Still to come, what is the number one goal of more than half of working women around the world? Yeah, it's not exactly what you think, and it's not what those pictures suggest either. And if you are an employer, or if you even just know a woman, you would be wise to know this answer. And also, remembering Angela Lansbury and her family's terrifying escape from Charles Manson. And no, this is not a TV script. It's next. You have probably heard the term quiet quitting. Sure have on this program. It's the idea of pulling way back on your hours or your effort before your job pretty much takes over your life. Basically, it's doing enough but not going above and beyond. At least 50% of the American workforce is quiet quitting as we speak. According to a study by Gallup, those are the numbers. But guess what? Plain old quitting outright, loud quitting, is still really in vogue, especially for women. The consulting firm Deloitte surveyed 5,000 women in 10 countries around the world, and more than half said they plan to quit their jobs altogether in the next 2 years. Half of them worldwide. Female middle managers are apparently the unhappiest group of all. 64% of them said they're getting out. That compares to just 21% who are in upper management, if they could get there. And why? Researchers are saying it's a perfect storm of work responsibilities, parenting responsibilities, and then the added pressure to go back into the office post-COVID. I'm joined now by Kim Rittberg. She's a former media exec who ditched her job to run her own business, and she also hosts the podcast Mom's Exit Interview. I just love the title of it alone. So is this a temporary trend, Kim, post-COVID? I mean, I know everybody's kind of all wound up about whether they're in, they're out, of the office, home, go, commute, don't commute. What is it?
This is just a new name for something that's been going on for quite a while. Women, and especially moms, feeling burnout and feeling that there's a lack of flexibility in their job is definitely nothing new. It's just a new phrase for it.
What I can never get over, because it's what's the year? 2022, almost 2023. Why aren't we more evolved? Why are women feeling so much more family stress than the men are? I see men sharing these duties all the time, but ultimately the women are the CEO of the family, right?
It is a great question. I mean, essentially jobs want us to be there working 24/7, and then your family needs you 24/7, but there aren't 48 hours in the day. So that's where it comes to play. And there's that whole second shift, right? The double shift. Mom goes to work and they come home and there's housework and childcare and caregiving and permission slips. And it's sort of never ending.
But dads are there way more than when I grew up. You know, I don't think my dad changed any diapers. Nowadays, that is just standard. It's kind of 50-50 for a lot of houses. And people, if you're out there and it's not, fix it. I guess what I'm asking is, with all the evolution in the family dynamic, why are women still feeling this push and this crunch and the stress more than the men are?
Men are definitely participating more. So I'm not, the dads are doing great work. But the truth is, a lot of that burden is still falling on women. The numbers bear it out, and anecdotally it bears it out. On Mom's Exit Interview, I talked to moms across the country, and they still feel overburdened by the home, the housework, the childcare, in addition to the work. So even though, yes, dads are definitely participating more 100% than our parents' generation, there still is that imbalance.
So this is important. You know, what can companies do? If there's a bunch of, you know, managers and corporate leaders out there watching right now thinking, oh, God, not this again. What can they do to stop this trend? What can they do for the female employees who they may not even know feel like this lady?
Don't be like that lady, for sure. Paid leave, definitely don't be like her. Paid leave is one of the biggest things. For example, I was a media executive and I was given 3 weeks of paid maternity leave. And think about that as an employee. When your company is only willing to give you tiny bits of time to recover from having a child, what message does that send to you as an employee? And of course, you actually need that time to recover. So I think number one is paid leave is very important. And number two is creating those boundaries. So especially now we're seeing with hybrid and remote work, in some ways it's incredible, but in other ways, there's no off switch. And so I think it's really important for managers to respect boundaries, especially when you have parents, bedtime, nighttime, you know, you want a parent there for that. And so I think it's really important for managers to not just say, oh, your child is so cute and look at a photo on your desk, but really acknowledge that you are a whole person. And when you leave that job, you're still a parent.
Okay, I got like 10 seconds left, but I have to ask you, is it ever, ever, ever going to happen again where we have an 8-hour work day like my mom and dad did?
Oh my God, if you just made that happen, I would love that so much. Maybe you're just predicting the future. I really hope so. I do hope burnout diminishes, and I hope that the boundaries are created, but also the expectations are lowered.
Well, we do so much more, so much faster because of all the technology. I sometimes think, why can't an 8-hour day be, you know, far more productive than 70s just on its own with how fast and, you know, how high paced we are. But we can always dream, and maybe we can group meditate on it. Kim Rittberg, thanks so much for being here. Nice to meet you.
Thank you. You too.
Coming up, you may have heard that the great Angela Lansbury died yesterday at the age of 96. But did you know about her connection to one of America's most feared serial killers? The real-life Murder, She Wrote plot that had Angela running from Charles Manson. That's next. So when Angela Lansbury died yesterday, just 5 days before her 97th birthday, her remarkable body of work was really like flashing before our eyes. But 8 decades on the screen, right, and the stage, it's just unmatched among actors. There's this story, though, that a lot of people don't know about Angela, and it has nothing to do with acting. It's about Charles Manson. Believe it or not, Angela Lansbury had a brush with that notorious serial killer back in the 60s. Her daughter, Deirdre, fell in with a crowd that was all in on Manson. And then when the drugs were injected into that, Lansbury nearly lost her daughter to Manson's family of followers. And it got so bad that Lansbury had to give up her acting career and pick up her family and move as far away as she could from Charles Manson and his cult. She moved them to Ireland. And there she stayed off screen for a whole year, nursing her daughter back to normal. Here's what she told The Independent in 2014. It pains me to say it, but at one stage, Deirdre was in with a crowd led by Charles Manson. He was one of the many youngsters she was one of the many youngsters who knew him, and they were fascinated. He was an extraordinary character, charismatic in many ways, no question about it. For his part, Manson tried to downplay the power that he wielded over so many young hippies who lived with him on the Spahn Ranch. Here he is with Tom Snyder on 60 Minutes back in 1981.
They said I had a great family and I was the following and leaders and all that. There was no followers and leaders, a bunch of kids out at the ranch.
Deirdre would go on to have a family of her own in Los Angeles. So there's her mom, Dame Angela Lansbury, acclaimed actress and singer, but whose greatest triumph may have actually been mother. That is it for us tonight. But coming up on Chris Cuomo, Bill O'Reilly is mad about what he calls anonymous source garbage. And he tells Chris what Americans should really be skeptical about. Cuomo starts right now.